Guardian Unlimited.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly.
Wait a minute, crazy
what?
Fool.
What?
I ain't getting no plane. Randerson, get out of my seat. Producer
Oi.
Ben, music please. And on this week's show, Darling, Are You Lonesome Tonight?, we return to the tale of Lonesome George, the 80-year-old giant tortoise who's thought to be the last of his species, or perhaps not. Plus, we discuss a new clinical trial to cure childhood blindness using gene therapy. And Gaydon Robinson from the Natural History Museum is here to join us to talk about the perilous future for Britain's moths. All this plus musical proteins, a mathematical mystery, and James Randerson's secret admirer. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. You'll be delighted to know that we're back at full strength in the pod this week. In fact, if anything, we're probably punching above our weight. That means that the Guardian science correspondent, James Randerson, is here.
We always punch above our weight.
And thanks for keeping the old seat warm while I was away. Our tech correspondent and sometime caped crusader, Bobby Johnson's also present, if not entirely correct.
I'd like to see you punch above my weight, Alan.
Mel Bowes is back from sailing the seven seas. Aye, aye, Captain.
Ahoy there.
And our studio guest this week is one of the Natural History Museum's most eminent entomologists. Try saying that after four white wine spritzes. Dr. Gaydon Robinson, welcome to the pod. A pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Feeling nervous?
Yes.
More from all my co-podders in just a moment. But first... sitting in his usual seat, which he never actually leaves, it's our producer, Ben Green. Now, Ben, is it true that you've got some special composition for our listening pleasure this week?
Well, actually, funny you should ask that, Alok.
It is funny, isn't it?
It's hilarious. I've been combining my twin roles as the producer of the music show and the science show, and I've come up with this little thing. What you're currently enjoying is it's a musical interpretation of an amino acid scale in C major, of course, in which all the amino acids are ordered by their relative hydrophobicity. You like it?
Yeah, sounds like a resounding no to me, Ben. Why don't you just play us some proper music instead?
On a pedestal and push you till you fall. But George, I know you're man enough to rise above it all. George.
I said proper music. I don't know. If there's one thing this podcast doesn't need, it's more country music sung by cowboys with big moustaches. Anyway, we're playing that marvellous ditty by Nashville legend John Metcalfe because it's about a fella called George who's lonesome and loveless. And some of you will be at least one step ahead of us here. But for Ben and everyone else who's slow on the pickup, let me explain. Lonesome George is the 200-pound giant tortoise from the island of Pinta in the Galapagos. He's become something of a conservation icon over the decades because he's the last of his species, or at least that's what scientists thought until last week, when a genetic survey of the giant tortoises on the Galapagos showed that another of George's species was recently breeding on the islands. Now, the ecologist and journalist Henry Nichols has written a book about George's life. James and I caught up with him and began by asking what sort of efforts have been taken to ensure that the lineage of Lonesome George is sort of carrying on.
He's been relatively low priority. Nevertheless, they have tried a few things. They brought a couple of females in from a different island, so a different species essentially, but they can still interbreed and produce fertile offspring, we think. And so the hope was, of course, that we'd get a hybrid tortoise that would have at least some of George's genes. He absolutely refused to show any kind of interest in them, preferring instead to sort of mount a kind of rounded stone in his enclosure.
The new research, though, it suggests that there's a hybrid tortoise on another island that has sort of some genes which are sort of similar to the one to George's species. Now, in terms of how exciting this is for the biologists on the Galapagos, I mean, how significant is it?
sort of mixed, I suppose. On one level, on the kind of public relations level, it's extraordinarily exciting. It's totally unexpected. This is absolutely, well, it stunned me. I never thought this sort of thing would happen. Don't forget, for most of the 20th century, there really were no tortoises left on Pinta, that the island George comes from. And now there's quite serious evidence that a Pinta tortoise has been breeding on a different island within the last 30 or 40 years. Now, that's just extraordinary. From the point of view of recreating a population, a viable population of Pinta tortoises, so getting George to breed with any of these other tortoises, that's going to be very expensive and very time-consuming, and they'll obviously have to think and balance those two things off against each other.
James, you've got a question.
Henry, the other tortoise that's been found is a male, is that correct?
That's correct.
So if George wasn't interested in a female that was fairly close, maybe a male may be a bit of a step too far.
Well, I don't know. Some people have suggested George is gay, so it may sort of solve one animal welfare concern.
It's not going to solve the repopulation concern, is it? Like?
No.
But how likely is it that they will find a female?
On sort of terms of probability, yes, because in this current study, they collected blood samples on this volcano back in 2000. It's taken them till now to actually detect this Pinta ancestry. But they just went ashore onto this volcano and collected blood from 27 animals, just the first they kind of found, and then got off. It's kind of an inhospitable place. So they just wanted a little idea of what was going on. They found this one individual in those 27. If you scale that up to 1.5, maybe 2,000 tortoises that are out there, you know, the chances are that you would find it had siblings, especially because the tortoises lay a clutch of 10 eggs. So this tortoise was presumably part of a clutch. It's going to have siblings. Now, there's a debate. There's a kind of, we're not sure whether those siblings would be male or female, because, of course, tortoises have temperature-dependent sex determination, and usually a whole clutch is a one sex. So they could find a whole lot of kind of half-brother-type things for George. But if the father of this tortoise has bred on other occasions, well, we could well turn up female tortoises with Pinta ancestry, and that would just be extraordinary.
How long has George got before he's
18
popping
now,
his clogs?
Well, he is 80, and we don't know how long giant tortoises live, because he's in captivity and well looked after. He might have another 100 years.
That was Henry Nichols, and I'm sure he'd be happy for us to say that the paperback edition of his book, Lonesome George, The Life and Loves of the World's Most Famous Tortoise, is out right now. What do we think about Lonesome George here in the pod? I'm a bit of a fan of his. Gaydon, you're a conservationist. I mean, what do you make of this upturn for old George?
Well, I think we're all of us sitting here keeping our fingers crossed for George, because it would be rather nice to think that after 80 years of humping around a large round white stone, he could actually find a compatible friend, preferably of the opposite sex. These chaps with their DNA sequences are going to have to get back onto that volcano and do a bit of hard work, I think. This is just the crack in the door, and it now needs them to kick it open.
They need to sequence the DNA of 2,000 other giant tortoises, which will take some time. Nell, you're a fan of George's, aren't you?
I am, but I'm quite interested to see whether they'll actually let him, if they do find someone with inevitably slightly mixed Pinta ancestry, whether they'll allow him to mate with a hare, because that seems to be part of the problem with Lord George, is that there's that we shouldn't take on an unnatural approach to conservation, and that.
Well, there's only one of him. I would say unnatural approaches is a fine when you've got just one chance. They've tried everything else, haven't they? Bobby?
Well, I've got three things to say. First, I wish we could play the little clip of the Swiss tortoise fluffer again at some point. The second was, what do we call George if he's not lonesome anymore? Do we just call him George? Because that's not as exciting.
We asked Henry this, and he said that I think he'll always be called Lonesome George, even if actually he turns out to have others around.
And my other question is, if George was found on Pinta and the other evidence is found on another island, does that mean maybe that we've been looking at it the wrong way around? The reason we can't find any of George's relatives on Pinta is because he didn't come from Pinta in the first place.
You're a genius, Bobby. Well, we've put a link up to a video on YouTube involving a tortoise and a wok that really needs to be seen to be believed. Enjoy. British scientists set to launch the world's first clinical trials of a form of gene therapy that they hope will cure childhood blindness. Researchers will test the treatment on volunteers with a rare inherited form of the disease known as Leber's congenital amaurosis, in which a single defective gene causes the retina to degenerate and eventually stop working altogether. The treatment's controversial because patients will be injected with a virus modified to carry a correct version of the faulty gene. But if the trials prove to be successful, it could revolutionise the treatment of more than 100 inherited forms of blindness that affect up to 30,000 people in Britain. Well, we can speak now with Robin Alley, a geneticist at University College London, who's going to be leading the trials. Robin, thanks for joining us. Can you just tell us a bit more about this particular disease you're working on? What is congenital amaurosis?
There are 100 different types of inherited retinal degenerations, each caused by a different single gene defect. And the condition that we are attempting to treat in this trial is a form of Leber's congenital amaurosis caused by a defect in gene encoding RPE65. Patients with this particular gene defect are born with very, very poor function that declines with age.
How do you fix it with the virus, that as we mentioned?
The gene defect results in an absence of any normally functioning RPE65 enzyme. And the trial is to test whether we can use a genetically engineered virus to replace the missing gene product. So essentially, we're delivering a normal copy of the gene encoding RPE65 to replace the defective gene.
This has been tested out, I'm assuming, in animals so far. I mean, how successful has it been there?
Well, we've tested it in both a mouse model and a dog model of the disorder, and the mice and dogs have an equivalent genetic defect. And when we put the missing gene back into the retina of these animal models, we've been able to demonstrate, we and in fact other groups who've carried out similar preclinical experiments have shown that we can restore vision to both mice and dogs. And in the case of dogs, it's particularly convincing because we can demonstrate, not only using electrophysiological tests, that there's improved function, we can observe that the dogs are able to navigate their way through a maze following treatment, something they just couldn't do before treatment. So one has very convincing evidence that the dogs can have improved vision and they can see.
In the clinical trials you're about to start, I mean, how much do you expect the sight of the children to improve? Are they going to get perfect sight at the end of this, or is it going to be sort of at least 50% to normality?
We have actually already started the trial, so subjects, and they are subjects rather than we're not providing a treatment. We're testing this new approach, and we start the trial with young adults. We anticipate that we're going to be more effective in younger patients because the disease process has not advanced as far in those patients. So that the trial is phased, and we will be treating younger and younger patients, and we have different expectations depending on the age.
How long do you think before it sort of turns up in the on the NHS?
Well, it's going to be quite some time before gene therapy is a routinely prescribed treatment on the NHS. However, the fact that the inherited retinal degenerations have no treatment at the moment whatsoever, gene therapy is probably the only possible treatment for these patients. The fact that we have now moved into a clinical setting and testing a therapy that's proved very successful in animals means that it may not be very long before the NHS is having to make some very careful decisions about whether it's able to fund therapies to treat patients with some forms of inherited retinal degeneration.
Robin Alley from University College London, thanks very much for joining us. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, the author Donald O'Shea tells us about the mystery of the Poincaré conjecture and the Russian genius who solved it. Plus, the future's bleak, and the future's a giant light bulb. We'll find out from our special guest, Gaydon Robinson, on what'll become of the UK's moth population. It's all coming up, of course, you lucky, lucky people. But now, it's time for a roundup of the other news from the world of science and technology that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. This is the News Jam.
News Jam.
The world is running out of time to address climate change and to avoid the worst effects of rising temperatures, warned an influential UN panel. using energy more efficiently, using renewable sources such as wind and solar power, and new technology to dump carbon dioxide underground can all help to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the experts say in a new report. And most of the technology needed to stop climate change already exists.
One of the active ingredients in cannabis inhibits psychotic symptoms in people with schizophrenia. That's according to a small trial that compared its effect against a leading antipsychotic drug. In 42 patients, cannabidiol was as effective as the drug at improving symptoms, and it had less pronounced side effects.
Scientists have discovered a section of DNA that dramatically raises the risk of coronary heart disease and doubles the risk of younger people suffering a heart attack. Up to a quarter of Caucasians carry a copy of this gene, which raises the lifetime risk of a heart attack by 60%. It is the most potent genetic risk factor for heart disease yet found.
And finally, the Ministry of Defence plans to open its top-secret X-Files to the public. The files, that document eyewitness accounts of possible UFO sightings, will be placed on a public website within weeks. Unless they're stolen by aliens first.
And that was your News Jam. Thank you, Nell and Bobby. Anyone care to add anything on these stories? James, probably?
Well,
you've always got something to say. What do you want?
Cannabis. Yeah, normally with cannabis, we're talking about THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active ingredient that gets you high. But the research that they've got there is really interesting because the more THC you have in a plant, the less cannabidiol you have in a plant. Because of the biochemistry of the plant, the two are kind of mutually exclusive. And so we know that the THC content of cannabis has been going up 2 to 3 times over the last couple of decades because growers have been making it more potent. And that means there's been less cannabidiol in the plants too. Now, the interesting thing about that is that THC is thought to be what's responsible for the precipitating schizophrenia and psychotic symptoms. The evidence is a bit shaky, but that seems to be what's going on. And it may be that you're kind of getting less of a balancing effect of cannabidiol in the plant, something like that going on.
If this cannabidiol is going to be used potentially as a pharmaceutical, we're not talking about people going out and smoking joints, are we?
If they're going to get it to the stage of, you know, some kind of antipsychotic drug, then obviously they're going to distill the stuff down and have the pure extract itself. So no, people won't be smoking cannabis if they're schizophrenic.
In fact,
that would be an exceedingly bad thing to do. If you're schizophrenic, don't smoke cannabis, it'll make you worse.
Gayden, can I bring you in on something? The first report there from Nell was about the IPCC report, the latest one on mitigating climate change. And it one of the details in that was that we've only got 8 years to stop sort of the worst effects of climate change from sort of taking over the world. I mean, you must be surrounded by people at the Natural History Museum looking around and seeing biodiversity sort of collapse everywhere because of climate change. Have we got 8 years there? Or, I mean, are some places just too far gone because of climate change?
Well, we're looking at a variety of changes, one of which is climate change, but of course in the case of the groups I work on, which are tropical insects, specifically small moths, Microlepidoptera, the real threat is from deforestation. To be honest, I am not aware of any programmes that are looking at the effects of climate change on tropical insects or indeed the tropical fauna, if we leave the marine habitats out of it. The obvious risk is on tropical mountaintops where you have endemic populations of mountaintop species, and they are very strictly linked to a particular altitude, a particular climate, and climate change is, as it were, going to just pop these off the tops of the mountains. We are not going to even be able to see it happen. It's going to happen before we can get there to measure it.
James, you've been looking at some of the detail of what the IPCC have been talking about. What kind of things are they saying that we can do to mitigate climate change over the next decade?
Well, you know, it's the usual list of things like carbon capture and storage, nuclear power, changes to forestry, waste disposal, biofuels, those kind of things. I mean, in one sense, it's a kind of good news story. It's the third one of the IPCC's reports. The first two are sort of unmitigated doom and gloom. And this one's saying, well, we can do something about it. I suppose the sting in the tail is that they're saying it is going to cost us, particularly if we want to keep the rise in temperature down to sort of 2.5 degrees, which is looking pretty unlikely.
Thanks for that, everyone. And if you out there in Podland want to add your thoughts to any of these topics, send us an email or post a comment on the blog. Details coming up at the end of the show. Here we go. Well, this is the story of a near impossible mathematical mystery, a reclusive Russian genius and the race to win $1 million. As Run DMC might say, the Poincaré conjecture was tricky, tricky, tricky. Well, it foxed generations of mathematicians for nearly 100 years. In an astonishing paper in 2002, a reclusive Russian mathematician called Grigory Perelman claimed to have cracked it. Despite his achievement, the enigmatic mathematician has been reluctant to bask in glory. In August, he was awarded the coveted Fields Medal, an international prize that's often referred to as the Nobel of Mathematics, but he refused to accept it. We can now speak to Donald O'Shea, who's written a book about the history of the problem and the drama in solving it. Donald, thanks for joining us. Let's start at the beginning. Who was Poincaré, and what exactly was his conjecture?
At the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 20th century, Poincaré was probably the most famous mathematician and physicist. His work framed much of 20th century and indeed 21st century mathematics. He was nominated for the Nobel Prize 48 times, didn't get it. The Poincaré conjecture, he wrote 700 papers. Six of them started a new field called algebraic topology. And at the very end of his last paper, he had asked a question, which he had asked a number of times earlier, that pertained to the shape of objects that are now called three manifolds. They're possible models for our universe, and those are spaces in which if you travel out in any direction, you come back, but there's no wall and they don't go on forever.
In your book, you call a conjecture a bold guess about nothing less than the potential shape of our universe. So it's pretty fundamental stuff, isn't it?
It's very fundamental stuff. After two-dimensional shapes, which are surfaces, the next simplest are three-dimensional shapes. The field topology looks at shapes of all dimensions and how they're connected up. If you sail around our Earth, suppose the Earth were cloud-covered. At many times at Columbus, it's often thought of prove the Earth was round. Well, he didn't. Basically, what he showed was that if you, if you sail off in one direction, you'll eventually come back. If you know that, what's the possible shapes the world could have? Well, one is it could be like the surface of a sphere, but it could have also been like the surface of a bagel, or it could have been like the surface of a pretzel. You can look up in the sky and you don't see bagels, but suppose you couldn't get off or look out, or suppose we were cloud-covered like Venus and you couldn't drive out. How would you know we weren't living on the surfaces of a bagel as compared to living on the surface of a sphere?
It's obviously quite a complicated and fundamental idea, as you've intimated, but it was solved by this very odd mathematician, Grigory Perelman. Now, can you tell us a bit more about him?
First of all, he was a student in Russia. Went to a well-known high school in Leningrad for science. On the Soviet Olympiads, there's a kind of mathematical competition for high school students around the world. He had placed first with two others. And then he came to the U.S. for postdoctoral work. He knocked off some big problems, but then he went back to Russia about, 13 years ago, and nobody's ever heard from him.
He's quite an enigmatic character, isn't he?
He's very enigmatic. And, you know, I thought for sure he would show up for the Fields Medal, because that's the highest award you can get in mathematics. He cares deeply about mathematics. It was jaw-dropping when he didn't. It's not clear whether he would show up for the Clay Mathematics Award or not. That private institution had made a list of the seven greatest problems in mathematics, and the Poincaré conjecture was one. It was on everybody's list, and nobody expected it to be solved this soon. But it's pretty clear he's done it, and nobody's sure he will show up for that either.
Donald, thanks for joining us. That was Donald O'Shea. His new book, The Poincaré Conjecture, In Search of the Shape of the Universe, is out now, with more details on our blog. I'm still a bit confused. I'm not quite sure what the shape of the universe is. Did anyone else in the pod get it? Gaydon, did you work out what the shape of our universe is?
Well, I understood it to be bagel-shaped, and I think we're hitting trouble with this, because if we have a bagel-shaped universe, that tells us something very fundamental about the nature of God. And that is bad news for Richard Dawkins and quite bad news for quite a few of the religions on this planet.
Well, apart from the whole Judeo-Christian thing. Okay, we'll get Dawkins into question that later. Thanks for that, everyone. Moths. Now, you don't hear much about them, certainly not on this podcast. And actually, in the wider world, you're less likely to read about them, more likely to read about their elegant cousins, the butterflies. Well, it's time to set the record straight. Last week, conservationists here in the UK launched a national recording scheme so they can catalogue which species of British moths faced extinction. It's come about because research suggests that two-thirds of the larger moths in this country have declined over the past 40 years. Well, Gaydon Robinson's our special guest in the pod this week. You've heard him chipping in on all of our discussions so far. Now, sir, it's your time in the spotlight. The new campaign is called Moths Count. Before we get to that, why do butterflies get such a good press and moths are always seen as the sort of, like, lurking evil bad guys?
Well, moths have the reputation of eating your clothes. They're dull, brown, buzzy and come hurtling in the windows at night and frighten people. Whereas butterflies are gay, colourful, they sit around on flowers and are generally the sexy part of the order Lepidoptera. And moths, as you say, just tend to get a bad press, and really not for very good reasons. I mean, there are 2,500 species of moth in Britain, of which, you know, there are two of those species are clothes moths, and the rest are all fairly innocent.
And so are they all sort of declining in this country then?
You'll hear older people saying, oh, there aren't as many butterflies around as there used to be when I was a boy. And you will also find people who've worked with moths for a long time, and particularly those who've run moth traps, who say that the total numbers that they are seeing are much lower. When we actually go into the data, and this survey, which was set up by the British Butterfly Conservation Society, and I believe launched by David Attenborough, this was set up specifically in response to what is probably the world's longest-running multi-species population data set. It's the Rothamsted Light Trap Survey. And my understanding is that this data, which is effectively how many moths do you collect in a light trap every year, which has been running since 1932, this confirms the figure that we are down considerably in total numbers. Now, that total numbers figure has to be taken as total numbers and not total species. The number of resident species in Britain has not changed significantly. We've lost a few, we've gained a few since the early 1930s, but certainly in the space of 75 years, numbers have gone down, and we want to know why, where, whether that change is concentrated in particular areas.
Nell, you've got a question.
What's your favourite theory for why the numbers are declining, even though the species number is staying relatively constant? And what's your wackiest?
Well, somebody has got to do some fairly serious and detailed statistics on this. But the first explanation that I've seen put forward, and I think it's probably a valid one, is changes in land use. The face of Britain has changed enormously since the 1930s, with loss of habitat, loss of hedgerows, intensive farming as opposed to ploughing or using a lot of horse-drawn equipment. And pesticide use has been repeatedly blamed, but pesticide use has actually been slimmed down, refined, since the 1950s and early 1960s, and still the decline seems to go on. My favourite wonky theory, and it's my favourite because it's mine, is that it's actually a trapping effect that we're seeing, that the number of moths probably hasn't gone down that much, but the numbers that are coming into traps is much smaller because of light pollution. In the 1930s, there was almost no public lighting. The output of light from cities was very, very much lower than it is today. And we really only got this fad for high-intensity illumination on main roads in the 1970s and 1980s. In the areas where the survey traps are, on even a slightly hazy night, there will be light in the sky that wasn't there 50 years ago. A light trap for moths is competing with peripheral lighting sources, including the most important of which is the moon. If you count the moths in a trap, there's a 28-day cycle, and you get the fewest moths at full moon. Now, I wonder whether, overlaid on that, there's the light pollution question. And again, somebody needs to go in and do some really good stats on this and just work out what's going on.
So another terrible thing from light pollution there. Bobby, what's your question?
Yeah, well, it's maybe not as serious, but I was just wondering about clothes moths. You said there were two species, but what do clothes moths eat if they can't get hold of clothes?
The menu is very, very simple. It's keratin in almost any form. So that's wool, fur, feathers, and once you get rid of domestic habitats, you're left with mammal corpses, feathers in birds' nests, feathers that have just been shed and are lying around. So, I mean, clothes moths are the one of the clearer uppers of the animal world.
Like the dung beetles.
Exactly. Yes.
The
yes.
dung beetles of the sky.
Yes. But we'd be knee deep in feathers if there weren't any clothes.
Imagine that. Gaydon, we'll wind up here, but quickly, we've mentioned the colourful, wonderful world of butterflies and everything, but you know, moths is your thing. Do you have a favourite?
Yes, I do, actually. I'm almost hesitant to say. My favourite is the clothes moth.
Ah.
I cut my teeth in my career as a micro lepidoptera taxonomist, somebody who classifies these things on reworking the clothes moths, because everybody was making the most dreadful mistakes in their identification. To be honest, I love them all. I've just come back from a collecting trip out in the deserts of Arizona with an old friend, and there isn't a shortage of moths out there. Absolutely
wonderful.
Doesn't
sound like a bad job at all. Thanks so much, Gaydon. The blog has been positively heaving under the almighty weight of your responses to the showdown between Robert Winston and Richard Dawkins. In all, a staggering 24,199 words were posted on that subject alone, most of them by Choo Choo, London Eye, Grown Up, Rulfo One and Centrist. This is a debate that will certainly run and run and run and run and run. I think it's best if you all agree to disagree. Anyway, James, you've got a sort of a flavour of one of them.
Yeah, this is a more conciliatory post from Holly Park. I understand that God believers are hurt when it's implied that they are stupid or irrational to believe in a God. The task of atheists is to find a form of words that delivers their message without hurting the feelings of those who believe otherwise. This is an immensely difficult task.
Okay, we'll leave that there for this week. I'm sure it'll be back in the future. Next up is a quick word of apology to HRH Pod. If you're still listening, and we genuinely hope you are, Ben read out your comment last week in the style of an elderly man with a whistle. He's prone to that sort of thing. Whereas the HRH Pod points out...
I'm young, female, and from Yorkshire. Oops, sorry, I can't do the accent.
Sincerely, Miss Pod, it was nothing personal. Moving on, hello to Trudy, who wrote...
James R. came to my school a while ago, right, yeah, to do this thing about writing articles and taxi pollution and stuff. James, I saw you today in Islington Town Hall, innit?
That's wrong.
Which we,
that's so wrong.
We should leave that right there. Finally, thank you to all our friends at New Scientist magazine, whose podcast isn't nearly as entertaining as this one, by the way, who said...
We love Alok. He should do ads for Timotei, and he's bad at poker, though.
On that bombshell, it's time to draw the curtain down on this week's show. If you want to get in touch about anything we've discussed, email science@guardian.co.uk, head to the blog, or make your way over to myspace.com/guardianscience. If you're new to this well-oiled machine that we call Science Weekly, you'll find a full archive of our podcasts at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. It's another bank holiday this weekend, so why not catch up on some of the science and nonsense we've been putting up in the last year and a bit. My thanks to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Bobby Johnson, Captain Nell Bowes, and our special guest, Gaydon Robinson. Science Weekly is produced to within an inch of its life by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jha, well, someone's got to be, and see you next time.
Guardian Unlimited.